maybe one or two showers. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, the north and west of both likely to see the bulk of the showers. The further east you are, generally speaking, the drier your day will be, I suspect. And the temperatures here around about 7 or 8 degrees. If you can, do have a very peaceful night. Good night.
Thanks, Phil. Now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week, the broadcaster Sally Magnusson continues to read Where Memories Go, the account of her mother Mamie Baird's long struggle with dementia. Today, while Sally and her siblings are coming to terms with their mother's gradual memory loss, they fail to notice that their father, Magnus Magnusson, is also ailing.
Your twin sister Anna takes me aside one day in October 2006. She says, "I think your dad's failing." They call pancreatic cancer the silent killer because the symptoms are so often put down to something else. Now it's Anna who spots what you, devoted but cloudy, attached but disengaged, have not. At the moment she puts her disquiet into words, "I see too." I suggest he consults a specialist, and my father agrees with such little demur that I realise he too must have started to wonder. Back at your house, I go and perch on my favourite spot on the radiator in the study, next to his leather armchair. "You knew, didn't you?" "Yes, I knew." "Well, you get to know your own body, and as Thor said, you can't fart against thunder."
"Did Thor really say that?"
He laughs. "Well, I may have embellished that one." It's Christmas Eve. The log fire is crackling and the lamps are on as the light outside seeps away. The room comes into its own at these times, all gold and mellow. Dad loves it. He's sleeping on the couch here at night now because he can't manage the stairs to the bedroom. We dress up to the nines for him. We cook, we murder Silent Night in Icelandic and go wild with the candles. When I stroke Dad's back and shoulders, I can feel every bone. But his eyes glitter with pleasure. Perhaps because we expected so little, it was the happiest of Christmases. We cannot beat death itself, but here, perhaps, is the way to trounce the miserable business of dying. This is what my father taught us on his last Christmas Eve. On New Year's Day, I decide it's time to take you aside and explain, as gently as I can, that Dad does not have long to live. You react with a flare of anger that shakes me.
"You mustn't talk like that. Dying? Dying? That's a wicked thing to say. Your dad will be fine."
That old, optimistic verve of yours that had rallied us so effectively last time had come to this. An unshakable, demented, forgive me, Mum, I even said that word to myself, inability to grasp what was going on. All that made sense to you was the steady love to which you held fast when everything else was shifting. A love that insisted he could not die. You've been sitting nearest him all day, stroking his hand, dropping kisses on his forehead. Nothing will induce you to leave his side. His breath becomes light. Light as air. A soft, pittery wisp of a thing that is barely there. And then it's not. You're holding his hand. You look stricken. Grief owes so much of its traumatic force to memory. As the American physicist Austin O'Malley said, it is yesterday that makes tomorrow sad. You mourned my father's loss with a sadness at times acute, but more often, so it appeared from outside, muffled and distant. Your yesterdays were going, and with them a clear sense of the husband who was no longer there. I often wondered how much you were aware of this blunting of the sharper edges of bereavement. You gave me the answer one day,
after you became upset over losing a hat he had bought you. With an insight that rocked me, you said, "I made more of losing your father's hat there than I did of losing him, didn't I?" I wondered then whether you sensed you had let him go too easily, the love of your life. On the surface, your mental energies seemed to be directed less into grief than into resenting Anna for her attempts to look after you. Together in the family house, without my father's genial presence as a buffer, you twins rubbed against each other with mounting friction. "I could strangle you, Anna," you tell her one day, teeth clenched as she urges you to eat up your porridge. Afterwards, I ask why you spoke to your sister like that, you who were always the peacemaker, the smoother of family tempers. "I'm used to being independent," you say, looking sheepish. We three sisters, Margaret and Topsy and I, are all ashamed now of how often we upbraided you in this fashion, as if you could help what you were saying, as if we could somehow argue you out of speaking in a way you never would have before your brain came under attack. Day to day, you were still functioning well enough. It's a mercy of this disease that there are so many bright days to be relished before winter closes in. If only people can be helped towards living rather than dying. Those were the days when it was relatively easy to turn a bleak afternoon into what you regularly pronounced to be the best day of my life by snatching you out in a way, even just to the end of the road or into the garden for a bonfire to break up a long evening. But there was trouble ahead. In January 2009, Topsy accompanied you to London for a stay at my other sister Margaret's. 5 days later, I took a call as I was about to go on air with the 10 p.m. headlines. It was Margaret. "Is anything wrong?" Small gulp. "She's broken her hip. She's in hospital." I find you sitting up in bed, stony-faced and belligerent. "Sally, I'm surrounded by mad people," you declare by way of welcome. We stay at your side all day. After waiting all yesterday for an operation, another day is in full swing with no prospect of action. I accost a nurse. "I know my mother may not be a medical emergency, but she's deteriorating mentally. Does that not necessitate any kind of urgency?" "Oh, I'm afraid it happens all the time with elderly patients," she says. After the operation, you return by ambulance to a drab rehabilitation ward for the elderly in a hospital near Glasgow. You appear, as ever, invigorated by the adventure. "The bin men were so kind," you confide, indicating two burly ambulance drivers. A young doctor comes and sits by your bed and suggests she might ask a few questions. You look alarmed. "Do you know what day it is today?" "Saturday," you guess. The doctor places a small cross beside the first question. "And the date?" "The 3rd of January." Another tiny cross on the sheet. "Do you know what year it is?" persists the doctor. "Would it be 1946? You answer politely. I feel tears welling up. "Don't do this to her. Please stop." "I'm going to write something on this paper. I'd like you to do what it says on it." The doctor writes, "Close your eyes" in capitals. You glance at the paper and obediently screw your eyes up tight. "Go for it, Mum." Topsy and I give you an ecstatic thumbs up behind the doctor's back. The examination receives its first tick. "Now," says the doctor, "I want you to write down a message for me." You take the pen and start to write. It's wobbly but bold enough. You know what you want to say. The doctor takes it from you and smiles. Topsy and I lean over to read and then shout with laughter. "Oh, Mum, our wonderful, smart mother. You may think this is a Saturday in 1946, but who else would be quick enough to write, "Thanks for the memory"? Your eyes shine, and I catch that spark of your old wit, the glitter of achievement in your eyes. I have it still. It's a daily battle to be allowed in to keep you company outside visiting hours. It seems extraordinary that wards devoted to children actively encourage close family, while in old people's wards, where there's the same need for a familiar face and touch, relatives continue to be considered a nuisance. "I'd be really grateful if you'd let me be with her. She gets rather confused," I say quietly. "We have a lot of patients who get confused," retorts a nurse, "and we can't have all their families coming in." "Fortunately, you're doing so well with the daily physiotherapy sessions that you'll be out soon." When I ask how you're feeling, you send my spirit soaring with your careful linguistic command. I feel a continued indebtedness to the people who are helping me to perform these things, but a little tired. I must remember this line the next time you announce with confidence, as you did the day before, "It was the straw that broke the camel's egg." Your dementia is not as advanced as Joan's, a former primary school teacher who spends much of the day weeping. Joan is crying again in her armchair. When I go to comfort her, she says she wants to have a sleep in bed. But I can't get out of my chair. Like you, she has no clue how to press the red button for assistance. My policy is to act as a fifth column, ringing the buzzer of the person who needs help and then darting back to my seat beside you to wait for action. A nurse comes at last. "What's wrong, Joan?" she asks in a loud voice. Joan is not hard of hearing. She says nothing, sits with her head bowed and eyes tight shut. "What's wrong, Joan?" "She'd like to have a sleep," I pipe up from beside your bed. "She told me she'd like to get into bed." The nurse ignores me. "What's the matter, Joan?" she roars. "Why did you ring your bell?" "I think she's tired," I hazard again nervously in a squeaky voice. This is ridiculous. "What do you want, Joan?" bellows the nurse. No response. I bite my tongue. The ward holds its breath. Eventually, the nurse asks, more softly, the yes or no question most likely to elicit an answer from someone with dementia. "Are you tired, Joan?" Joan nods. "Would you like to get into bed?" "Yes, please." This nurse is a pleasant woman and no harridan. I know perfectly well that she and her colleagues, with so many dementia patients and little, if any, dementia training, are on a hiding to nothing most of the time. In fact, I'm even starting to wonder if this might be a disease that turns all but the most saintly carer into a kind of monster in the end. It's something I'll have cause to consider in the months to come when I stare into my own mirror. According to her daughters, Joan had few signs of dementia at all when she arrived here a few weeks ago to be treated for constipation. Now she's at a more advanced stage than you. My sisters and I vow that if we can possibly help it, you will never be in another hospital again, as long as you live.
And tomorrow, Sally is shaken to discover her mother has forgotten something that seemed far beyond forgetting as she continues to read Where Memories Go. It was abridged by Sarah Davis and produced by Justine Willett. The Shipping Bulletin rounds off our nights here on Radio 4 in just a few moments after some sailing by. BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday the 6th of February. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Forth, Malin, Hebrides and Bailey. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Irish Sea 966, expected Faroes 973 by 1800 Thursday. New lows expected Fitzroy 974, Lundy 977 and Southeast Iceland 972 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, 40s, Cromarty. Southeasterly 6 to gale 8, occasionally severe gale 9, except in Cromarty, veering southerly or southwesterly 5 to 7. Rain or shower.